What if we could exchange our fossil fuel dependence for an existence based solely on renewables?
Around the world, renewable energy use is on the rise. And these alternative energy sources could hold the key to combating climate change.
There are so many awesome innovations with great potential. Wave and tidal energy, bird-proof wind power, paint that gathers solar energy. What will we think of next?
If you listen to the news and read the papers, it would be easy to be convinced that the transition to a sustainable, low-carbon future energy system is already underway. Advocates say that renewable energy is already cost-competitive, with the cost of generation falling below that of fossil fuels. According to them, the transition is all but inevitable. Yes, we may still be using fossil fuels, but only as a temporary measure as we all move to cleaner energy. We're probably past peak use of coal, and with the daily improvements to our capacity for wind and solar energy, clear skies are just a matter of time. Welcome. You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. I am your host, Sean Macheza. Here at the State of Power podcast, we're very concerned with the state of power, because hardly anything has a greater impact on the future of our planet than the ways in which we generate and consume energy. Our guest on the program today believes that some of the optimism with regards to renewable sources of energy is ill-placed, and that we have to face the reality that we have a lot more work to do before we can even begin to talk about a transition. Sean Sweeney is the coordinator of the Trade Unions for Energy Democracy, TUED, a network of more than 80 unions from around 25 different countries. TUED is based at the City University of New York, School of Labor and Urban Studies. The following conversation is centered around an upcoming paper that Sean has written together with John Treat. In the paper called The Energy Transition Myth, the authors look at the numbers and use them to challenge many of the claims that we are well on our way towards an energy transition. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast, Sean, my namesake.
Yes. Hello, Sean. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Let's just get right into it. If you read the news, if you open any newspaper currently, there's a lot of optimism about the fact that, you know, a low carbon future energy system is very possible. It's already underway. Sustainability has been a buzzword for such a long time, and the general idea is that we're well on our way to reaching a point where our energy use and our energy production systems are not going to be having such a huge impact on the planet. Is that a vision you share?
No, in fact, it's completely contrary to the data that's out there about energy trends and also the timeframes involved for decarbonization, which are not compatible with current climate science.
So what does the data that you have access to say?
Well, the way we sum it up is what we're seeing at the moment, and have been seeing really for decades, is an energy expansion, not an energy transition. So when we look at renewable energy, which is usually one measure, a significant measure of decarbonization, you'll see it growing very rapidly. So it gives an impression that the entire energy system is being decarbonized, because what's good for renewable energy, this reasoning goes, must be bad for fossil fuel energy. But it's not true. The energy use is growing between 2-3% per year. Of course, there was an interruption because of COVID, but that energy use is still mostly met by fossil fuels. And even in the electricity sector, where renewables are making strong progress, there is still very little displacement of fossil fuels outside of the developed countries, where renewables are growing a little bit faster than they are elsewhere. So that's the reality.
So maybe for somebody who's not really aware of this topic, who's coming at it right from the basement, what is this vision of, I guess they call it green growth, the possibility that we could continue growing but not having that much of an impact on the planet, I think. Could you break it down for me what exactly we're talking about?
I think it's green growth grows out of a sort of a neoliberal worldview that the private sector either is the solution to pretty much all social problems, or governments need to do is make sure that the policies are in place to encourage the private sector to invest, which we can return to if there's time later. But the basic vision is it's possible to decouple emissions and energy use from economic growth. And this is completely not, again, not supported by the facts. And usually the countries like, say, the UK, where I'm sitting right now, it's got economic growth, but its emissions have gone down. So that's often presented as evidence that the there can be growth, but there also can be a reduction in energy use and emissions. The problem is most of that is due to deindustrialization and the movement of carbon-intensive economic activity to places like China and India. So if we look at it overall, there's a shift in where the emissions have been generated, but there's been no decoupling of growth from emissions.
So those countries that are effectively claiming that they've reduced their emissions and they've gone greener, are essentially reporting a reduction, but not necessarily an overall reduction, because whatever pollution they've been responsible for has simply moved to elsewhere on the planet.
For the most part, yes. So take a country like Norway, for example. It's a massive exporter of oil, mm-hmm. but the oil is burned somewhere else. So, and that shows up in the emissions of countries who are importing the oil. Switzerland's another example, a country that's got high levels of hydroelectric power, for example, which means it has a low carbon electricity system, which is a big help, but it's also importing products from manufactured goods from other countries. So there are many examples of this shift to of industry and carbon intensive activities to other parts of the world.
Correct me if I'm wrong, because the impression people have is that that's the whole point behind having this, is it emissions trading or carbon trading, right? To say you pay for the right, essentially, in other countries that would have the possibility to have a certain level of emissions can then get can trade that capacity with others that don't. And the overall idea is that it doesn't then matter where the emissions are, as long as they're capped at a particular point.
Well, of course, in theory, the idea of a price on carbon to reduce emissions makes some sense. The problem is there is no price on carbon, certainly not an effective price. The only carbon, or rather the greenhouse gas emissions that are covered by a price, is about 17 or 18% of all emissions. But the price is so low in most cases that it has no effect on the way employers and companies invest. So they just pass the price downstream in, it's basically a cost of doing business. So if there's a price, for example, on petroleum for cars, and that usually gets built into the price at the pump at the gas station, so it doesn't really affect the amount of emissions that are being generated, other than in probably an incremental way. But that's the fundamental problem with carbon pricing. By now, it was expected there would be a global price, it would be in all countries, certainly the major emitters, and that it would be at a level that was effective to change investment decisions. At the moment, none of that has transpired. So that's the problem.
So essentially, you still have the same amount of pollution, the same amount of emissions as even before we tried to put a price on the actual pollution.
Well, of course, we don't know what would happen if there was a global price. Certainly, in theory, if the price was high enough and it was universally applied, it's conceivable that emissions could be mitigated. It could come down even. The problem is the price doesn't exist. And that's because it's a cost of doing business, and it either gets passed on to consumers or it eats up profit margins under a capitalist system. Pricing carbon seems to be implausible. And from a policy perspective, it should be dumped.
It should be dumped, you say?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, I'll be curious. I think we'll come to what you then think is the alternative.
Of course.
The thing is, so if carbon pricing doesn't work, there's you mentioned in your paper on the energy transition myth that there's like two sides to this, right? There's the carrot and the stick.
That's right.
The carbon pricing is the stick to say, okay, if you don't restrict your emissions, you're going to pay. You're saying that's not effective. Is the positive part, the carrot, at least being effective?
Yes, certainly the carrot has been a little bit more effective than the stick, because the stick doesn't really exist. It's like a toothpick, really. It's not really doing its job at all. yeah. So let's focus on the carrot. So the idea then is that if you start from the belief that the private sector will be the main driver of the transition, and that the government's job is to make sure that the private sector feel comfortable in investing in order to ensure returns to private interests, then you structure policy based on trying to provide incentives to things like renewable energy and also green technologies, electric vehicles, and so on. But the problem is, again, that the incentives are either very expensive so that governments start to pull back from subsidizing wind and solar, for example, which is what's happened in Europe, or electric vehicles. The subsidies for electric vehicles are very generous, that go straight into the pockets of the manufacturers and the battery producers. So yes, the stick is a little bit more effective, but it's reached a point where the costs are so high that governments are pulling back in some cases, in many cases, in fact, with these incentives.
So governments are finding that the cost of actually subsidizing for this green alternatives is too high. So they're actually stopping with the subsidies.
Well, some of it is because the way they've structured the subsidy, that in the case, for example, of wind and solar power, the subsidy was based on a general subsidy. So if you generate electricity, you got a certain price for it, which would make it profitable for you to generate the power. But many governments realized that the way the subsidy was structured, it would end up on the electricity bills of end users. And what does that mean? That means residential users started to complain that the renewable energy component of the bill was rising in places like Germany and Denmark and Spain. Or big industrial users started to say, well, if we're paying for these subsidies in the cost of electricity, we're not going to be competitive with countries where they don't have a carbon price or a subsidy. So you end up then with a policy backlash, which has affected deployment of green technologies and renewable energies in many countries now.
So nothing has really changed then?
Well, you know, climate policy, which was sort of grew out of the neoliberal model, was really developed in the early 90s at the height of the triumph of the market and the belief that the private sector could do no wrong and governments could do nothing right. That kind of thinking had a big influence, dominant influence really on the policy. And in those 30 years, all we can see is the emissions levels have actually gone up faster than they did in the previous 30 years. So whatever we can say about the policy in theory, and we can debate about whether it could have been done differently, et cetera, but we can only conclude that the policy has been ineffective in controlling, let alone reducing emissions. So it behooves us to find a different policy.
It's not just that the policies are there and countries are perhaps not adhering to them strongly enough. Maybe there's need for a little more commitment. Is it that the policy doesn't work, or the application of the policy could be better done? I think that could be what somebody would argue, no?
Well, let's present it as a question. I mean, does anybody think, if we know the data, that the policy, which has not worked for 30 years, if it was more aggressively applied by governments, that it would be successful. Well, it's possible in theory that if there, again, if there was, say, for example, a carbon price, which is the stick, if there was a global carbon price of, say, 100 euros per ton, then yes, it's possible that emissions could come down. But then we have to ask the question, well, why isn't there a carbon price? And the reason why there isn't is because it's a cost of doing business. It pits corporations against each other, countries against each other. And therefore, there is no universal introduction of the price. To think that it's going to happen anytime soon is basically entertaining a fantasy at a time when we need to be aggressively reducing emissions globally. So the idea, which is what neoliberals often put forward, that people like the Sir Nicholas Stern, who was one of the main architects of this policy, insist, as do the neoliberal think tanks, that it more ambition on climate means more neoliberal policies, more aggressive application of those policies, more policy supports, which means subsidies for renewable energy companies, for example. So that's their approach.
And so in this particular scenario, we're not meeting the Paris goals, are we?
Well, there's two types. First of all, let's sort of disaggregate the goals. The first goals were the temperature thresholds, which said that if we go above 1.5 degrees, we're in trouble. If we go, we should try to limit warming to 1.5 and at a minimum, well below 2 degrees Celsius, which was the language used in the Paris Agreement. Mm-hmm. And studies have been done most recently from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in 2018. Issued its report, which was titled Global Warming of 1.5 Degrees or something close to that. Mm-hmm. And they concluded that emissions have to be brought down by 45% by 2030 in order to stay within a 1.5 degree pathway. So there's that target, the temperature targets. Then there's the nationally determined contributions. And pretty much all the governments who are party to the agreement, and that's about 180 more governments, have made commitments that the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change say do not add up. Even if they were implemented in full, they would still lead to emissions increases. The increases would be slower than they would be if there were no targets. But nevertheless,
so even if the targets were adhered to, we wouldn't make it.
That's absolutely true. And that was acknowledged 5 years ago when the Paris negotiations came to a close.
Yeah.
Governments were told, thank you very much for putting your voluntary pledges and commitments on the table, but please come back 5 years from now, which was supposed to be in last November. It'll be this November in Glasgow, please come back with higher levels of ambition, because at this rate, we won't be anywhere close to reaching the temperature targets. Now, the problem is that not only were the commitments inadequate, but they're not even reaching those commitments. So it seems little, it seems pointless to be calling for more ambition at this stage when what we've got is a map, and this is the United Nations Environment Programme acknowledged recently, that we have a growing gap between ambition and accomplishment or action. So there are many countries, many cities who've adopted ambitious targets. In fact, the targets get more ambitious, but the implementation or action component gets less ambitious. So that gap is growing to almost absurd and laughable levels. If it wasn't such a serious question, we could be all having a bit of a joke at the moment.
Wow. So to take it back to some of the interventions that have been tried. I mean, here in the Netherlands, you walk around, there's a Tesla vehicle at every corner. And the impression that you'd get is that, well, there are a lot of electric vehicles, there's clean energy being used. Every other house has solar panels on it. People are trying, right? It seems people are more aware of the need to be conscious of energy use and to find alternative sources of energy. Is this at least making a dent?
It's making a dent in the sense that if there were no electric vehicles or if there were no solar panels, the situation would be more serious than it is at the moment. So yes, but then we have to ask, well, how big of a dent is it making? Mm-hmm. What we're seeing is, again, an ongoing expansion of energy use and emissions levels. So countries, for example, they're on the highest levels of emissions at the moment, and that's mostly like in South Asia, but other large developing countries are growing their emissions. They have probably no real electric vehicle market at the moment. That may change, but at the moment, there's very little renewable energy coming into, or rather, let's look at somewhere like China, where the deployment of solar has been record levels for recent years. I think at once upon a time, not too many years ago, China had the highest deployment levels on an annual basis. But in an economy where energy use is growing 5, 6, 7% a year, mm-hmm. all that means is that fossil fuel use is growing alongside renewable energy. So uh-huh. that's what we mean by energy expansion.
So clean energy may indeed be expanding, but it's racing against fossil energy that is itself expanding.
That's right. If we look at, say, for example, British Petroleum every year produces an annual report on energy trends. Mm-hmm. And it's actually raising the alarm. There's every year their chief kind of economist or researcher, his name is Spencer Dale. He's been sounding the alarm now for a number of years saying.
So this is the oil companies themselves raising the alarm.
Yeah, he says, look, if we look at 1990, you know, we've had an enormous growth, certainly in the last decade, of wind and solar power. And from 1990 to 2020, we have seen this quite spectacular growth, but we've also seen no change at all in the energy mix globally. In other words, all of that growth is barely keeping up with the increased demand. So energy use from 1990 to about 2015 was almost 60% higher than, you know, that's a massive increase.
And this is after everybody has raised the alarm and sustainable development, in quotes, is on the agenda.
Precisely. Look, I wish we could sell a happier story, but we've got to face the reality. We can't live under the illusion that the transition is unstoppable, inevitable, well underway. Every headline we read says, yes, that's the case. And so all we need to do is pursue and be more aggressive about the current policies to make sure that we are going faster. But the truth is we're going in the wrong direction, and that's because of the policies are not effective in addressing, you know, emissions increases and energy use.
So what do we do then? Which policies would work?
Well, now then we get to the question of a social revolution, because I'm being a little bit facetious, but we don't know what will work, but we do know that the current policies are not working. The first thing we need to do is acknowledge this. This is why John Treat and I wrote The Energy Transition Myth, because there is a denial across, we talk about climate change denial from the political right, but from the political left, the soft left in particular, there is a denial about the energy transition. Mm-hmm. And the environmental movement is complicit in this, largely because, and they'll say, you know, if you ask them, leaders of that movement often are pretty upfront about it. They say, we have to keep our activists inspired. We have to show that there's progress. We have to have a good story to tell. Plus the renewable energy companies, which are, have a very close relationship to some of the more mainstream environmental groups, mm-hmm. want to create the impression that things are going in the right direction because they want more policy supports, more protections from the competitive market. And that's because they want to make money from, you know, the subsidies that are on the table. So their thing is, their message is, please, please give us a few more years and we will be competitive with fossil fuels. And look, we're growing very fast. So, you know, just a few more years and things will be fine. What they call the tipping point. So every headline is about the price of renewable energy coming down and being competitive with fossil fuels. And that's a messaging, that's a public relations exercise in order to convince politicians that they need to be continuing this support for private, for-profit renewable energies, storage batteries, and so on. So we know that this is not working. We have to, first of all, see that it's not working and acknowledge it. And then we have to have a discussion about what might work. And so we got some thoughts on that. It's not addressed in great detail in the paper we're discussing today, but I'd certainly be happy to give my opinion or assessment of what's possible.
I'd be happy to hear that. But I just wanted to follow up really quickly on what you just said, that we need a social revolution indeed. And there's been talk of a tipping point, a particular moment when things fundamentally turn around and we go on a different path. And there was a lot of talk, right, since the pandemic hit. COVID-19 came into the picture. It was like global emissions have reduced. The airlines are grounded. Industry is stopped. Maybe this is the moment when we take a turn for the better. Is this what's happened?
Well, I think it's a little bit early to say whether it's happened or not. I mean, what we have seen is, yes, of course, there was a contraction in energy use and emissions levels fell. They fell to roughly the level of around 2015 or so. But of course, that bought us really no time at all, because the trajectory, the International Monetary Fund and others are predicting growth returning to pre-COVID levels pretty quickly. And that means emissions will just get back on the bike and carry on again. Actually, the bike is probably not the right image.
Back into again, the SUV.
Back into the SUV that does 20 miles to the gallon or, you know, whatever, 4 miles to the liter, whatever. So, no, it hasn't happened, but the debate around the vaccines and vaccine nationalism, vaccine apartheid has been useful in the sense that it's drew attention to not just inequalities in the global system, where rich countries have more than enough vaccines and poor countries like India that exports vaccines have none available or inadequate amounts for themselves. Yeah. Same is true of South Africa and elsewhere, Brazil under Bolsonaro. So yes, it's drawn attention to that. And there have been calls for a public goods approach to vaccines. And that opens the door to, well, if that is what's needed for vaccines, why not technologies that can actually put us on a pathway to reducing emissions? And one of the areas that would need to be developed, mainstream policy has flagged this now for decades, is energy conservation and efficiency. So the reason why that is, it's flagged, but as a policy, it's neglected. And this goes back again to the failures of the neoliberal approach. If, as the green growth narrative would have us believe, that there's a massive business opportunity in transitioning to a low carbon future, then why has energy conservation and efficiency not gone forward at great speed? The fact is, there is no money in energy conservation and efficiency. So it has to be done by a public goods model. For example, let's take residential use. Yeah. Residential use, let's say, I'm only guessing what it might be in the Netherlands, but say my apartment, I have a one-bedroom apartment in Brooklyn, New York, and my monthly charges are about $50 a month. So I don't own that property. But even if I did, what would I do? Would I spend $3,000 to insulate the windows? And how many years would it take for that to pay back? And it, you know, if it's based on these kind of consumer choice and money saving or profit making, it's not going to work.
The individuals eating better and using less plastic kind of perspective.
Well, it what that does is it does encourage a certain sense of stewardship of the environment. You know, we all should take some responsibility, but yeah. Those practices make us feel that we're, you know, if we're doing it, everybody
but
should
we're doing
do it.
Enough.
Yeah. Let's just say, for example, the energy use of a large box retail store, for example, the energy use is phenomenal. So let's say electricity costs were doubled in order to preserve electricity. What the company would do would just pass those costs down to consumers. It would make the products more expensive. It wouldn't necessarily alter the, you know, it would have probably, there would probably be an assessment of an electricity use, and there might be economies introduced here and there. There might be some technologies introduced to sensors, for example, that might turn off. But we're talking about refrigeration, we're talking about heating, we're talking about air conditioning. Mm-hmm. How can you radically alter those patterns of consumption? That's the challenge that we face, and we shouldn't delude ourselves into thinking that, you know, lifestyle change is going to make much difference, or even what they call the price mechanism is going to have much effect when those prices can be passed on. So that's that's one of the issues we have to deal with. And face the reality, as sobering as it is, it's better to do that than waste a lot of time, you know, promoting and recycling of plastic bags or something.
So then I dare to ask, what would you do if you could change everything? How would you go about reconfiguring things? This current system is not working. What system do you think might?
Well, if we can show that it's not working, that's the first task. And that means then our allies in the environmental movement will have to face the reality. We will all have to face the reality. Governments who have got zero carbon commitments will have to acknowledge that their policies are not on track to reach the net zero commitment. So the political discourse would have to change. So then that raises the question, well, then if it does change, what policies might be more effective? Well, a number of things would need to happen. If we're talking about decarbonization across the economy, those are key sectors. The electricity is still the largest contributor globally to emissions. That's the burning of mostly coal and gas to generate electricity. The transport sector, which is in the global north now becoming the largest sector, the United States and Europe, for example, but globally, not so much because vehicle use is growing in the global south, but it's still minority of people have vehicles. So you would need to say what kind of energy resources exist in order to reach decarbonization goals. Then you'd have to look at, well, does that mean putting wind and solar panels everywhere? And even if they were publicly owned, how do we solve the challenges of what's called variable renewable energy? Because the wind doesn't blow all the time and the sun doesn't shine all the time. And yes, batteries may make a contribution, but that raises other questions about the...
Well, the mining, the...
Yes, exactly.
Minerals and...
Exactly. Now, the truth is, and I think this is one part of this paradigm shift that needs to take place is to recognize that all forms of energy have positives and negatives. We know that fossil-based energy generates emissions, but carbon-based energy, gas and coal, is very intensive. So a barrel of oil is worth about, in terms of horsepower generated from a barrel of oil, it's about 4 years of human labor, of one person's labor. Now, of course, these are very back of an envelope estimates because not everybody has the same strength as others, but if we wanted to do it in crude comparisons. Now, there's wind and solar, I'm sure, can make a big contribution to decarbonization, but it's very, very spatially challenging. So you need a lot of space. Nuclear is generating more interest, but there's still concerns about uranium mining, waste disposal.
Waste as well. Yeah.
You got it. So the same is true of gas. Gas burns a lot cleaner than coal. So for a number of years, it was considered to be a bridge between from coal to renewables would be the increased use of gas. But then with fracturing technologies, fracking essentially, the methane leakage and flaring that goes on with the fracturing of shale rock is generating one of the most potent greenhouse gases, which is methane, which is much, much more potent than carbon dioxide. Wow. So when you factor in the life cycle emissions of gas, it's probably no better than coal and may even be worse. In fact, some studies indicate that it is worse. Mm-hmm. So this doesn't mean to say we throw in the towel. It just means to say we need to reconstitute, reestablish very firm science-based approach, clear science-based criteria into all energy generation, knowing that it probably will be nothing is benign. Longer-term energy possibilities, hydrogen, tidal power, geothermal, they certainly capture the imagination as possibilities, but those too need to be looked at.
Still very far with, from...
I mean, a decade ago, they were talking about biofuels. So they started mixed sugar-based ethanol and corn-based ethanol in with petroleum, and that stopped.
Lots of people in Zimbabwe, where I'm from, stopped farming cotton and other stuff and started farming Jatropha because of this boom, which they expected biofuels, but now it's just wasteland.
Yes, exactly. The same in the U.S. They were growing corn for ethanol, which was taking up lots of space. And, you know, many believe that if it carried on that way, it would compromise the you know, arable land that was made available for food. So, you know, this is not an easy problem to solve.
No easy solutions.
No, there are no easy solutions at all. But what we do know is that these technical challenges related to energy supply and also energy efficiency are made worse by the profit system and the neoliberal policies that sustain that system. So, you know, it's way beyond my pay grade to come up with all the solutions, but I certainly know one thing, and I'm 100% confident that if the energy for profit model is getting in the way of a serious fact-based assessment of what needs to be done, and that is where issues of public ownership and a public goods approach to energy is so critically important, because it then means that what public energy companies reclaim to public ownership will not be assessed on how many electrons they sell. They will be assessed based on how many electrons they conserve or how much efficiency has been brought into the system. And that is social and ecological criteria can then be applied to energy interests. At the moment, shareholders want to know, what is your market share? Did it grow? You know, are you taking advantage of all the opportunities? And then you'll have what we've documented in our research, where you have an energy war where the main goal is to knock out the competition from other sources of energy. Uh-huh. And often climate arguments get used in the energy war. So even the coal industry will say, well, we're much better for the climate than something else, you know, because, well, if you've got electricity, that means families in poor countries are not using diesel to power their, you know, their lights, and they're not burning biomass in their dwellings which is also not just creating emissions, but causing a terrible health crisis for mm-hmm. people who don't have access to electricity. So even the coal industry is saying, oh, we are friendly to the climate.
So
we need a kind of a grown-up discussion about these things, I think.
Yeah, I think it's really necessary because, I mean, I can imagine even here at TNI and amongst many of our allies, we have a huge thrust on like really talking about municipal energy, talking about community solutions to energy. And I guess the idea is to say these are good to have, but may not necessarily be adequate for what we actually need, right? I think the point is not to say it's not to do it or it's useless, but rather to say in addition to it, we need something much more robust.
I think for people across the political left, it's where do you put your energy, no pun intended. I mean, yes, there's a lot of great people working in the area of community energy or energy citizenship. Municipalities are trying to do the right thing in terms of decarbonization. But, you know, this is not going to be done on the basis of ignoring the large energy companies and leaving them in private hands, mm-hmm. because municipalities may consume 60 or generate 60% of, you know, emissions globally, but they don't generate that much energy. Mm-hmm. The energy comes from outside. So it's a bit like, hypothetically, if a small town of 50,000 people imported all its food, it could manage the food better. It could recycle the food. It could make sure everybody has enough to eat. But at the end of the day, it doesn't control
farming
the food. It's basically imported from outside. The uh-huh. same is true in certainly of energy. It's not that municipalities cannot generate energy, but it's not going to be enough to sustain a modern economy. And reducing energy use it's got to be liberated from market criteria, from the idea that someone has to make money by reducing mm-hmm. energy. And that is not easy. It's going to need a regulatory approach. And it also needs a social mandate so that, you know, if we're serious about this civilizational threat, then we need to acknowledge there are certain things, certain major industries and services that have to be under public control. And then we've got a chance of planning our way through a transition towards decarbonization. It won't be easy. We may not succeed, but we have a much better chance doing it that way than leaving it to this neoliberal model of the stick that doesn't exist and the carrot that's not big enough. I think then that the main message of this conversation is the need to us to politically come to terms with the fact that there is not an energy transition, but there's an energy expansion, and that the current policies, which are based on a sticks and carrots approach, incentives and carbon pricing, that approach has been ineffective now for 30 years. And we need a massive policy shift at the global level towards a global public goods approach. Will that new approach solve the problem? We don't know. We do know that energy use has been growing now for generations. And so it's not going to be easy with any set of policies to have a dramatic effect quickly, but we can lay the foundations for a new approach. But that means a whole debate about what constitutes sustainable living, consumption, everything would be open for debate. And we can have that debate based on the facts, based on the realities, and not based on some idea, some fanciful notion that the private sector and private profit is going to lead us to a low carbon future. So if we can start with that, we've made a lot of progress in my opinion.
Wow, thank you so much, Sean. This really puts everything in perspective. There's a lot of work to do. You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. Thank you for staying with us this far. This has been a conversation featuring Sean Sweeney. This conversation is based on the report, The Energy Transition Myth, written by Sean Sweeney and John Treat. A link will be added to the podcast description.
If you'd like to find out more about this topic in general, use the search topic Energy Democracy on our website and explore what we have to offer. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you, and see you next time.